from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's Forum program, for his new film Boyhood, director Richard Linklater filmed with the same cast over a 12-year period to tell the story of a boy growing up. It was a risky experiment, but critics are raving about the film. Slate's Dana Stevens calls it a gradually unfolding miracle. And we'll talk to Linklater about Boyhood, his career, and his unorthodox approach to cinematic storytelling. Forum is next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Richard Linklater's newest highly acclaimed film, Boyhood, which premiered at Sundance, was filmed in 3 or 4 day increments over the course of 12 years. Set in Texas, the film is a coming-of-age story about a boy growing up, and it breaks new ground as it follows its central character over the 12 years of its filming from the first grade to college. Boyhood is Richard Linklater's, 16th, 18th feature. We're not sure who's counting, but his body of work includes the trilogy Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight, all starring Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke, as well as Slacker, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, Fast Food Nation, and Bernie. And we welcome Richard Linklater to this morning's second hour. Good to have you.
Hey, great to be here.
Well, this movie has been getting so much buzz. It's over the moon. I was saying off air to Richard that his head could easily be swollen. Masterpiece, wonderful. Oh, I mean, how's this affecting you?
Oh, I've been doing this too long. If this was my first film, I would be worried for my mental health. But if it was my first couple films, but I'm too entrenched now. It's
well, you're
great.
Also a patient man. I saw an article this morning in the paper that said, to film with the same cast of characters over 12 years, you got to be patient.
You can't. Don't get into filmmaking if you're not patient. You know, if you don't have patience, don't. If you don't possess that, this is the wrong medium for you. Because even making one film in real, the standard time requires enormous patience.
So I've got to say, on the record, I thought it was an extraordinary film, and Dan, our senior editor, saw it with me, and we brought other people with us, and everybody was moved by it, was touched by it. It had impact on all of us, and as I mentioned to you, a famous filmmaker called me the other day and said he loved every minute of it, Oscar-winning filmmaker. But, when you talked about it publicly, you keep coming back to the kid you found, Eller Coltrane, and what good luck there was, and instinct on your part, too.
Yeah, I mean, that was the decision for the movie. You know, I was going to follow this family, but in particular, the point of view is the kid's point of view, this boy we're following up, first grade to college. So that was a big decision, He was an interesting kid. I just like the way he thought, and you're sort of casting the family, too, a little bit.
Including your own daughter as a sister.
Technically, my daughter's playing his older sister. She took that part, by the way. I never looked for others because once she found out there was a part for a girl about her age, she just told me she was going to be playing that part. And I was like, okay, at least I'll know where you'll be every year.
One of those fathers who follows his daughter's dictum. She's damn good in the role, too.
Yeah, I'm really proud of her. She worked.
You should be. This is people talk about your trilogy, and those who have appreciated, it's a 20-year relationship, but it's not shot over 20 years. I mean, this is shot over 12 years. Yeah. This is breaking new ground, and you could have had so many things go wrong. I mean, the kid could have, anything could have happened to any member of the cast.
Sure. I mean, that's the bet you make, I mean, I guess it's a radical idea on one level, but for me, cinema's my life. This is kind of a cinema life project. It feels natural to me to try to, the idea to tell a story this way kind of allowed me a broader cinematic canvas to express something that I was feeling about, growing up and parenting. And so it's not so far out of the bounds of the way I think, but it was wonderful to get people aboard this, it was such a commitment, that commitment grew over the years too. But yeah, you have to look at it like things could go wrong. Yeah, it always could. Just there's a life analogy here. You know, you plan your life. You know, most adults can conceptualize the next 12 years of their lives. But, you know, you can't be assured, no matter how hard you're trying, it's going to work out that way. We can all get a phone call or be unlucky. But the odds are those big things aren't going to happen. You know, we did all make it. It was, you know, you had to look at the randomness of the unknown future. You had to look at that in this case, not as a threat, but as the fun secret sauce that was going to bring this film to life. The unknown was like, oh, that'll be our collaborator, our, you know, incremental collaborator over time will be the unknown. But that was also exciting.
You know? Well, as a filmmaker, you are collaborating all the time with your actors as well. Yeah. I mean, this is something that you bring to your filmmaking art, which, you know, has caused a great deal of debate one way or another. You know, should actors bring in their own point of view? How much do actors really have to offer and so forth and so on? And in your case, it's been really quite constructive for your art.
Oh, yeah.
It's been integral to it. Yeah.
Integral. You know, what I'm trying to do is create a reality that a viewer might take as real. So I find the only way I can get to that is it has to be so real for the actor, which usually requires a lot of rehearsal, a lot of work, a lot of conceptual time put into it. I mean, Patricia and Ethan, I can't describe what goes into something like this beyond the 12 years.
Yeah, I heard Patricia Arquette in an interview saying, I was just so sad when it was over, you know,
yeah.
Because you lived a life kind of in miniature, microscopically.
I know. It was such an interesting life project for all of us. We're still processing it being over. You know, the film's now in theaters or being released around the country, and we're kind of going, oh, does that mean we can't film this year?
So. Well, you said in another interview that time is the lead character, and I certainly got that. Time, I mean, it's really a movie in some ways about maturity, and it's not only the kids' maturity, it's also the parents' maturing
absolutely.
And so forth. But you know, I was reading something about you on an oil rig and doing work on an oil rig, a good Texas boy. Were you reading Proust and Faulkner on that oil rig? You were reading novels.
I was definitely reading. Yeah. I was definitely reading everything I could get my hands on. That was I guess I was out of 2 years of college, and then I was working on an oil rig for the next 2.5 years. But that's where I started the new phase of my life, educating myself, you know, jumped in. So I was reading.
But reading in a way to absorb really the art of storytelling, because that's what you do.
Yeah, yeah. Film is storytelling, you know. And this film, more than anything, I guess at age 17, my best version of myself would have been a novelist. But once I discovered film, that completely took me over, kind of the visual, you know, the visual aspect and the storytelling challenges of filmmaking. But I think there was a part of me that still goes through the world like a novelist. And this idea for this film it's a novel. You know, it's what you can do in a novel that you can't do in a film. A novelist can write, oh, and then he turned 12 and, you know, you can, you know, take on that canvas rather easily. But in film, you've got all these limitations, you know, say the actor's physicality at a certain age. You can't ask a 7-year-old who's representing a 7-year-old to, okay, in this next scene, you're 13.
And boy, do you like the real. I can tell.
You can't do that.
You wouldn't like to put in actors who look that different because you've got the same kid and the same people.
Well, because I'm interested in the continuity of self. So I want that same kid. You have to be able to ask the real question, is this kid at the end of the movie the same kid we met at the beginning? And we know it is technically, but it brings up notions of self. Are we the same people our whole lives, or do we change, or how do we change, or the whole nature, nurture, you know? Question, which is, you know, endlessly mysterious.
A novelist friend of mine, Ethan Kanan, once said, people don't change, they just reveal themselves, which I've always kind of thought about.
That's pretty good.
Richard Linklater, director, new film is Boyhood. It opens July 18th. His other films include Before Sunrise, Bernie, Dazed and Confused. It's quite a canon, as we say. And what I think really captured the imagination of filmgoers, speaking for myself and others, was you get to like these people, you get to care about them, you get involved in their lives, and their lives are very ordinary. I mean, there's dysfunction like in so many lives, but they're really, including a couple of stepfathers who blow you away in different ways, one a teacher, the other a student. But it's as if you want us to be sort of centered into their lives and not be able to escape from their lives. You're right there with them.
Well, the way we perceived cinema. You know, you sit in a darkened theater, these images come up, and you're kind of pulled into that world. It's the power of the medium. And so I thought we could get an audience to invest in this kind of normal family, whatever normal is. You know, they're not extraordinary. They're ordinary.
Yeah.
They're not super. Yeah, that title had already been taken. Ordinary People. That could be the title of this movie.
Could also have been 12 days. I think it was at one point. Or 12 years it was at one point.
12 years. Yeah, sure. We thought about that. 12 years. But we found out that was taken too, in a way.
With 10 years a slave.
Yeah. Yeah. So, they're kind of regular people. But the point of view is that of a kid growing up. So when people think, oh, there's not that much drama. But when you're a kid, it is. Being the new kid in a new school, that's pretty dramatic. Your parents splitting up or getting a new step parent, or that's pretty dramatic. So it was kind of the little dramas of everyday life that people can kind of relate to in a way that this film is just a collection of intimate moments that most of them would be cut out of other movies because they don't advance the plot forward at a quick enough rate. But I thought this would
no
work.
Car crashes.
No.
No bloodshed.
No,
yeah.
None of that. But plenty goes on. But like a life goes by. I was hoping the viewer would see it as kind of their own lives, like how we process time, how we process memory, how we process just the way we pass through time. This film, this canvas here of 12 years would kind of gave an opportunity to experience something a lot like what we all experience just as human beings, maturing and aging.
Well, the intent of filmmakers doesn't always match the product, but here your intent was delivered. I thought we'd maybe hear some cuts. This first one is of the family. They move several times, as you indicated in the film. And the first voice you'll hear is Samantha, Mason's older sister, played by Richard Linklater's daughter, Laurelee.
Goodbye, yard. Goodbye, Crepe Myrtle. Goodbye, mailbox. Goodbye, box of stuff Mommy won't let us take with us, but we don't want to throw away. Goodbye, house. I'll never like Mommy as much for making us move.
Samantha, why don't you say goodbye to that little horse attitude, okay? Because we're not taking that in the car.
Goodbye, old lady. Listen to Rod visit and ride the motorcycle.
That scene still evoke something in you as a filmmaker?
Well, that was year one. The family's moving, you know, that thing about being uprooted as a kid. You just go where your parents take you. You know, you might have the older sister who's a little more mature. She seems more upset by it. But that all just kind of affects you. But you realize, oh, that's how life's going to be. You're going to be dragged around. But the film, you know, it shows the emergence of self. Somewhere in there, the kid, it becomes more his life and less his parents and older sibling. And
Boyhood to manhood. Also kind of a portrait of the artist as a young man. I mean, because he does become, I don't want to give away too much of the plot here, but he becomes very handy with the camera. You know?
Yeah. I always thought somewhere along the way he would try to express himself. And I didn't have it exactly. I was going to wait and see what art form felt the most natural to Eller as he got older. I would have predicted music. You know, his dad's a musician. Maybe he'd be in a band or something. But he ended up a visual artist, you know, taking pictures, and I included that. But
that's true for the kid who plays him, Eller Coltrane.
Yeah, Eller Coltrane. He's taken pictures and he had a real interest in that, which he claims now he realizes, oh, he got some of that just from being on the movie set. From his whole life, you know, we have a set photographer who's taken pictures, who taught him a lot. And it's hard to say how he influenced the film, but the film maybe influenced him too. No one will ever be able
to. It's a symbiotic process.
Yeah, no one will be able to answer that question. I hope in a good way. You know, he's a kind of wonderful young guy. So.
Well, you talk about all these intimate moments in the film and the ordinariness of it, but there are also little things that are put in there. I mean, he has a camera, but he's also given a gun by a grandfather figure. In fact, I couldn't help thinking at one point in that scene, and these are really loving, decent people. I think that's really how you're meant to portray them. But Obama got in trouble in Pennsylvania for talking about people with their guns and Bibles, and the grandmother gives him a Bible, the grandfather gives him a gun.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole scene where, you know, filmed obviously while the election was going on, and they're working for Obama. You got some guy who says, I'm going to give away the film here, but who obviously is not happy about Obama.
Yeah, the prospect of an Obama presidency is not, you know, floating his boat at that moment. But, you know, that is an interesting scene. he does for his 15th birthday. Yeah, we're in Deep East Texas now, some step grandparents. They give him a Bible with his own name on it and Jesus' words in red. And this happened to me at age 13. I did get a Bible and a shot 20 gauge. And when Obama says they cling to it, they only cling to it in the misperception that those two things are under attack, their beliefs and their guns. And it's a divide in this country, unfortunately, and it really shouldn't be. I mean, these are just cultural things, and I think
there's a lot of popular culture in there. There's a Harry Potter thing, but you've also got some political stuff wrapped into it with the rant by Ethan Hawke on Iraq with a reference to Sarah Palin's pregnancy. Bristol Palin.
Yeah.
So it's all very timely. I mean, you're in the world at the time it's actually unfolding.
Yeah, it was fun to be on record at the time, the second episode, when Iraq was already – we could see what was that was going to be, what was predicted that he gets to at least say – I knew history would say, oh – everybody wanted to go in. Oh, it was so clear cut. But it wasn't. It wasn't. Millions protested. We begged them not to start that war. It made no sense to any thinking person. And yet, here we are all these years later. So it was fun in this film. We're making a period piece film, but we were shooting it in the present tense.
In different periods.
Yeah. So we're not lying about the emotion or the feeling of that exact moment. We're not going back and rewriting history. The film itself is history, so which was a pretty interesting dynamic for a film. You don't get to do that often. So,
also found, there are so many things to like and even love in this film. Just the way that loving parents can make an enormous difference, even if there's a split, even if what we used to call a broken family and all that. The sense of good people, even when the kid goes in, I don't want to go into details so much, but he goes into a store with a check to be cashed. The guy is so nice about cashing the check. They're just those little touches and nuances. But particularly as an educator, I was struck by just how important education is in this. I mean, not only because the mother's a teacher, but because the boy is with teachers who want to inspire him and affect him and have an impact on his life, and who do. And because at one point the mother sees this guy, he's a Mexican gardener, and she says, you can make something of yourself. Yeah. And he does.
He says, her advice is you should be in school.
Yeah.
And we run into him 4 years later, and he's gone to community college, and he's got his associate's degree. And now he's working on his BA. And you realize, oh, okay, that little piece of advice. So I believe that. I grew up in a family. I'm the least well-educated person as a college dropout in my family. We never had any money, but education was certainly important. And a lot of books in the house. So I was very lucky in that regard. I really believe in it. So, and we see those couple special teachers, pull him aside and kind of say, the whole movie, there's people kind of in your face giving you advice. And that's how it feels to grow up. Everybody, particularly men, are telling you, trying to shape you into something.
Mentor you, really.
It's mentoring, but it's kind of annoying sometimes. But then if you really could go back and listen to all those pieces of advice when you wish people would leave you alone, they actually are trying to help you. It's up to you to develop your facility enough to, filter through the advice and see what sticks. So we see a little bit of that in the movie.
Our guest is Richard Linklater, and let's hear another clip. In this clip, Mason, that is the father, and Samantha's father, Mason and Samantha's father, played by Ethan Hawke, is trying to get them to be more forthcoming about what's going on in their lives.
Talk to me. Samantha, how was your week?
I don't know, Dad, it was kind of tough. Billy and Ellen broke up, and Ellen's kind of mad at me because she saw me talking to Billy in the cafeteria. And you remember that sculpture I was working on? Well, it was a unicorn, and the horn broke off, so now it's a zebra, okay? But I still think I'm going to get an egg, right? Mason, how was your week? Well, Dad, it was kind of tough. Joe, he's kind of a jerk. Actually, he stole some cigarettes from his mom, and he wanted me to smoke them. But I said no, because I knew what a hard time you had quitting smoking, Dad. How about that? Is that so hard?
Dad, these questions are kind of hard to answer.
What is so hard to answer about what sculpture are you making?
It's abstract.
Okay, that's good. See, I didn't know that. I didn't know you were even interested in abstract art.
I'm not. They make us do it. But, Dad, why is it all on us, though? What about you? How was your week? Who do you hang out with? Do you have a girlfriend? What have you been up to?
I see your point. So we should just let it happen more naturally, right? That's what you're saying. Okay, that's what we'll do. Starting now.
Just a moment in parenting life. And by the way, there will be a sneak preview tonight at 7:30 and 8 o'clock at the Embarcadero Center Cinema and 7:30 at the Sundance Kabuki Theater. And tomorrow night, you can attend opening night Q&A with Richard Linklater in attendance at the Kabuki at 7 and at 8 and 8:30 at the Embarcadero. And difficulty funding this movie. It did get money ultimately from IFC, but yeah. I don't know if you're going to get difficulty funding ever again after this film.
Oh, well, that would be a nice outcome. Because it's hard to get indie films off the ground. And this was a particularly strange ask to ask someone, hey, fund my movie, but there's going to be no end product or no chance of you getting your money back for, like, let's say 13 years. But I got lucky. IFC believed in it and gave me just enough money every year to shoot it, you know, just to get it in the can, as they say.
But you had a track record, too. I mean,
yeah, I had made two films with them at that very moment that they were. I find if you can keep your budget low enough, you can actually do. I can at this point get these kind of odd projects off the ground, you know. Well, if you work for nothing, too, you know, that helps.
Yeah, and you shot this in 36 millimeter, the entire picture?
Yeah, we shot the stability of, like, you know, the 35 millimeter negative is the way to go. I never questioned that. But, you know, we got all the digital goodies in post where you could correct, you know, make corrections.
You were filming this while you were doing other films, though.
Certainly, yeah. This was kind of an ongoing project. By definition, for, I think, the adults involved, it was kind of all of our side project, but we were all really committed. You know, it was always on a, if not, it never hit a back burner for me. It was always on a, maybe a middle burner, front burner, but it was something just always be considering. But, you know, you make films because it's how they affect your life. It's subject matter you want to learn more about or delve into, and just it's you define your life by what you're working on in that way. So it was a fun project because it dealt with growing up and parenting, and those were just felt like bottomless wells of intrigue to me. There was I would never grow bored of those subjects. There were always there was just a mystery involved, that something to be figured out there. And you see the parents kind of consciously trying to be parents. You see the kids kind of growing up. It was just, you know, it was a fun life project.
Well, it was very eloquently done. Poignant film, moving, funny, captured life, really. And you captured a lot of music, too. I mean, you had to have a soundtrack here that was part of the years chronologically that you were unfolding for us.
Yeah, music is a, I think, I wanted this film to feel like if you're a young person, you know how you're more imprinted with the music of your youth. You can just say, okay, that was the spring of 07. Oh, that was summer, late summer, that song came out. You know, you kind of remember the music of certain times. You get a little older and it starts to blur. You know, like new bands or actually bands have been around 10 years, you know, as the decades go by. But when you're a kid, it's very specific. And the music covers a, you know, pretty big spectrum of, you know, there's some kind of iconic songs, but not all. You know, it's just music coming at you from different directions, depending on whose taste it is, who's what the source of it is.
Well, there's a moment, in fact, when the father, who, as you said, is a musician, excuse me, played by Ethan Hawke, he says, here's the Black Album. You
know? Yeah.
And some different Beatles songs from different times.
It's really sweet when you're giving your kids music and, you know, hey, check this out. It's kind of, you know, it's love. You know, it's what a musician parent would do. He's made the ultimate mixtape of the Beatles solo stuff. He says he's gotten the Beatles back together. And that's a real thing Ethan did. That was a real project in Ethan's life he did for his kids. And it's a good album. I liked it. I said, hey, let's work that into the movie.
Let me invite listeners to join us if you would like to talk with our guest Richard Linklater. If you've seen some of his movies, films include Before Sunrise, Bernie, Dazed and Confused. If you simply want to talk about filmmaking, we welcome your calls. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Richard Linklater, director and screenwriter, and his new film is called Boyhood, film with the same cast over a 12-year period to tell the story of a boy growing up. It was a risky experiment, but critics are raving about the film. In fact, Slate's Dennis Stevens, whom we've had on, calls it a gradually unfolding miracle. We're talking about the film and about his career, his unorthodox approach to cinematic storytelling. We were talking off air about our mutual admiration for François Truffaut, who I felt may have influenced his filmmaking and Discover did, and also about just the nature of filmmaking itself and what it provides. And you are, of course, welcome to join this conversation. We do invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and just click on the segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, and you can go to our Facebook page as well. Lots of ways to communicate with us. And let's begin with some callers here, and we begin with you, Nick. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
So I guess one of the main questions that I kind of find really interesting is that how did the development of the story, I guess, the idea change over the, you know, the 12 years and kind of going into it with, yeah, this idea 12 years later or this, you know, 12 years ago, and then now it's what it is, it's done. How did that change?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It's, yeah, how much can you prepare is the question for something you're going to be working on so long. And I think the answer is it's sort of both the macro and the micro. You know, like I had a pretty strict outline of what happens in the movie. We were definitely first through 12th grade. He goes off to college at the end. The family moves here. There's a new stepfather. You know, it was all the big stuff was all mapped out and never changed. The little stuff, however, the little details year by year were open to kind of a wonderful collaboration of my ideas and kind of the world that was happening around us and what was going on in my own actors' lives who were, you know, aging 1 year between shoots. So it's kind of where my ideas met the reality of them. You know, I have these kids. The film has to kind of reflect their reality. So it was going to adapt itself a little bit to the reality we found ourselves in every year. So it was kind of both. It was ultimately, though, I have probably 12 scripts to make this film. It was no one. And I was interested in the future. There were notes we knew we needed to hit at the end that we knew we were incapable of in the moment. It's like, well, we have to live that life and we'll know the right tone for that when we get there, but we can't even predict it. I mean, I have a feeling, but we have a signpost we're aiming for, but we won't know till we get there what's the right exact words and tone.
But you had an arc and you had an architecture. Yes. You even knew what the final scene was going to be, didn't you?
Yeah, I really believe in that. Films are all about structure. There's a certain mathematical precision I believe is necessary. I'm not very I want the film to feel loose, maybe improv'd or real, but it's not. It's not. It's a construct. It takes a lot of work, a lot of, you know, writing, thought, rehearsing, rewriting. So that's the process.
A lot of editing, too. Huh?
And a lot of editing, yeah. We spent a couple years. If you add it all up, we spent a couple years editing the movie. So,
well, Before Sunset, you said, was one of the scariest things you'd ever done to make art. Was this scary?
That was scary because I was going into characters that preexisted in another film. I was sort of invading my own cinematic space and continuing it. This was its own project, and it was a... I try not to look at it as scary or daunting. It was just this fun kind of exploration. I felt lucky to get the opportunity. But I knew if I thought about it too much, I would become scared. I just wouldn't allow my brain to go in a certain direction on this film. And that goes with all the things to be afraid of, what could have happened, all the negatives. But it's kind of the life analogy. How do you want to go through your life? You know, are you excited about the future? Do you see... You know, how are you going to deal with everything that comes at you? Or are you seeing it from a more of a worrisome perspective? So I was trying to look at the possibilities rather than the, you know, the fault lines that lie ahead, you know. So we got through it. Things did work as planned. Believe it or not, it's a boring answer to say, well, it is pretty much what I set out to do. And it kind of is.
Did you have some of those scenes? I mean, just I'm thinking some of the touches and some of the scenes that I was struck by. I was struck by many of the scenes, but like there's what I think of as a buddy scene where they're trying to break boards and mm-hmm. Young guy stuff, and they're talking about girls and all that kind of stuff. And it's funny, but at the same time, of course, it's very revealing of how young adolescent boys pumped up on testosterone behave themselves.
Oh, I know. And I had that. I always had that scene was going to be in the movie because I think we've all been on that little camp out and you end up around some older high school guys and just how crude they are. And it's a real shock of like, oh, this is how older guy. The whole movie, Mason is looking like, what's the appropriate behavior for a man or a guy older than me? And he gets all these examples and they're all over the map and some of them aren't very positive. But it was just a question of where to put that scene. Is that going to be after 7th grade, 8th grade, or 9th grade? So, but I knew that scene would be in there. And that's contrasted with, you know, he meets this girl, comes up to him, and they take a long walk. And it's very innocent talk about, oh, there's a junior high party. This girl has a crush on you. And it's kind of a young girl's perspective. And then he gets around these high school guys. And the contrast couldn't be bigger about how they're talking because they're older guys and, you know, they kind of screw with you. But I think the important thing in the movie is Mason kind of chooses ultimately not to be one of those guys.
There's also a scene where he's bullied. I mean, it's a brief scene, but and it's a funny scene in some ways. I mean, it's disturbing, but one of the guys who's the partner of the bully gives a sneering look that just, you know, captures something of that period too. That's really, I mean, nuanced.
Yeah, just pushed around in the bathroom. You know, who doesn't have a little bit of that growing up?
We'll have some more of our callers here. And we go to you, Philip, you're on.
Yeah, hi. So I'm wondering, this is to the director, if, you know, for me, I'm wondering if the movie-making process is sort of a self-discovery process, and if you have some sort of a thesis, whether explicit or implicit in your process, and over the course of the experience, the filming and the, you know, at any point, and I'm curious if there are any significant personal epiphanies that you'd be willing to share about your own process and development as a human being or just about the human condition?
Wow.
Wow, that is the big question. I hinted at earlier, you only take on a project like this in the subject matter that it deals with. You kind of anticipate that. You know, it was to be a deepening of my feelings about growing up and maturing. And, you know, you reconcile your own life, really. I think I was trying to feel my way through what it meant to grow up and what it meant to parent. And, I mean, I don't have a simple answer for that. There's no one epiphany, but it was just a general feeling about the way time flows through our lives, kind of the fleeting nature, how quick you grow up, how your mind processes these lives we're living, and the people that are connected to us and sometimes abruptly disconnected. So it really is just about life in general. So I came out of it with, and I think everyone involved in it came out with a kind of a deeper, richer, experience and appreciation of, I think anything that slows you down in this world and makes you appreciate time passing or just the notion of the fleeting nature of, just say how long we're even here, how long we even have this opportunity, you know, that's a good thing. So I had 12 years of that. So for me personally, it was a wonderful experience to even have to think about that. So.
Well, you can get very easily maudlin about the transience of time or how ephemeral our period is here. But yet this is a film I want to emphasize, which is filled with a kind of spirit of hope and is quite upbeat.
I hope so, because it's like, there's a certain poetry in it. You know, there's a beauty. You know, you got to think of it that way and not to be Pollyanna optimistic or anything. You know, it's just like, well, you earn it. You earn it by your own depth of your own feelings and observations. So it's up to each person to kind of, you know, push themselves.
You got some wisdom to impart there, Rick.
I'm like the guy who pulls you aside in the classroom and lecturing.
Yeah, you're the educator now, indeed. I couldn't help getting a feeling, though, that I kept thinking about Michael Cunningham's movie, which, it was based on his novel called The Hours. You know, yours could have been called The Moments. And that film kind of, you have Virginia Woolf, played by Nicole Kidman, and just bring Mrs. Dalloway's center to the film, and you just keep going down into this feeling of emotional abyss. Whereas you feel uplifted at the end of your film.
I hope so. Yeah, that's good.
Got a question from a listener. You probably hear this a good deal. Did the British 7-Up series have any influence or inspiration for the making of Boyhood?
I mean, I've certainly, like every film person, I've seen those, and I like them. But, I mean, this is kind of a different, you know, this is a narrative, you know. So it's as different as a documentary and a narrative. But I think those films, I think you see this idea more in the documentary realm because it's just flat easier to just go back and interview people and juxtapose. And It makes more sense in the documentary realm, I think, to a longitudinal survey. You know, that makes sense in documentary. But what that shows, that film, and say Steve James's work a lot in the documentary world, you see just the absolute power of the recorded moment. You know, cinema is a powerful medium. It captures a moment very clearly. And just the power of that, you know, as a record. You know, if you think of the early films, the Lumiere brothers, 1895, they're just filming life around them, a train pulling into a station, workers leaving a factory. And you can just feel the utter joy they have with this new apparatus that's recording life in real time. So to me, that's the basis just of cinema in general. So this is an old notion, what this film is really trying to do in that. But you see it, and it's powerful. You know, those Up films are powerful. I like them, and I know Michael Apted a little bit. He saw this film a few weeks ago in L.A. He came up to me after, and all he told me was, like, keep going. Isn't that sweet?
Yeah, that's very sweet. Any chance of a sequel to this one?
Oh, gosh. I really don't have an answer. You know, this one's too fresh. Like I said, we haven't even processed this being over yet. So,
yeah, you're still processing. By the way, speaking about processing, I just read the other day that you did the film Bernie, which was also a gem of a film. Could have been a documentary too, I suppose. The guy just got released from jail.
Yeah, just talked to him yesterday. He's doing well. Yeah, he's got a job. He hasn't cleared the State Board of Criminal Appeals, but he's out currently after serving 17 years. So, you know.
Is he living on your property?
Good for him. Yeah, he's currently living in a garage apartment, yeah, that I have. So I'm glad to provide that for him. Consider him a friend, you know. I got to know him in the process of making that movie. He's like the nicest guy.
That's how he's portrayed in the film.
And he is. It's, yeah. You know, it's just that film.
He's a murderer, but he's a nice
guy. Well, you know, that film begs the question what we're all capable of, given the wrong circumstances, the wrong situation, the wrong, you know, we could maybe all be capable of something like if the nicest guy in the world is capable, you know. So I made that movie to kind of alert people that don't be so sure when you this tough on crime thing. Like, you never know the situations that happen and what could lead to something. So
we're going to go to more calls and emails. Before I do, though, I was struck in reading about your life that you went to college. You said you didn't finish college, but you went on a baseball scholarship. And there's a scene of the Houston Astros actually playing ball, playing a lot worse these days, I suppose, than they were then when that was filmed. But first of all, what position did you play?
Through high school, I was mostly shortstop. In college, I was left field mostly.
And you always thought you wanted to get the American national pastime into your movie the way you did? Or?
Well, I just remember going to games a lot as a kid. My dad would take us to games and my sisters would come along. And it was just the fun of being at a game. You're running around, going up and getting a hot dog and, you know, just being at a game. It's just, I don't know, it just reminded me of, I think that's a thing parents and kids can do. You remember it fondly, you know, looking back on your life. So it was fun to get a snippet of that in the movie. And the dad's a sports fan. He's a fan of a lot of things. You pick up on your parents' passions, don't you? You know, whether it's their political views or what they're fans of, it's just kind of a thing you remember. The kids are pretty neutral. They don't seem to care one way or another, but the dad seems passionate.
Well, the one thing I was most envious of in this movie was the relationship, even though the father was divorced from the mother and, you know, moving around a lot during his life. Boy and the father had a solid bond. I mean, I love my father. I revered him, but never had, you know, camping trips with him or going to a baseball game with him is something I used to dream about, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it can make a big difference in life.
And sometimes the divorced parents, you get to experience just that parent to themselves. It creates, you have less time with them technically.
Quality time, they used to call it.
But it's high on the quality time. Yeah. That parent's giving you all their time for even that 2 days. And that's pretty special. Yeah.
Another listener writes, I have a 9-year-old and a 14-year-old. Is it a movie suitable for them to watch?
I think it's suitable for the 14-year-old. It's rated R, but only for language. And, you know, there's a little bit of teenage, you know, and alcohol use and things. But it's a little sexual talk. But it begs the question, like, what about our rating system, that we would get an R? There's just no violence or anything. But
well, there is some sexy stuff, a little bit. The boys being interested in those
14-year-old boy will not mind, trust me. But yeah, I think it's for him, not the 9-year-old. You could watch a little bit of it. I have 10-year-olds, and I'm not really showing it to, even though their older sister is one of the stars of the movie. I'll show them a little bit of it, maybe half.
And you can follow the history of video games to some extent just by seeing your movie.
Yeah, it's a record of technology and games over the last – of the century, basically.
Yeah, in fact, when Mason goes off to college, you know, suddenly you realize it's not a big surprise necessarily who your roommate's going to be. You've already been doing all this stuff on social media and Instagram. And
yeah, whatever. You already know them. You've been paired together by a, you know, program.
Here's a caller. Michelle, join us. You're on. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you. I feel like I grew up with your films. After Sunrise and Dazed and Confused, I watched those in college, learned about love and other things. But now I'm a parent of a 2-year-old, and I'm looking forward to viewing the film and appreciating its contribution. The viewpoint from the kids' point, where my parents were divorced when I was younger, and there wasn't really an example of how life was supposed to be. But then now as a parent, I mean, that excerpt that you guys played of the father asking the kid, you know, to tell me about his day, I could imagine that it would be similar, that I want to know things for my son and I want to have that connection, but I don't, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a playbook for it. So I appreciate its basis as history for me, like a yearbook for me a bit, the Iraq War and stuff as well. But also seeing Ethan Hawke as a parent wouldn't be a bad thing either, so. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Well, this film is a, you see two parents very consciously parenting. I've talked to friends who've seen it, and they kind of, it really makes them think. Some people call their parents and talk to them a little bit.
After seeing the film.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Like, oh, I didn't know what you were going through, Mom. The film sort of so enforces the point of view of the parents, even though it's the perspective of the kids, you kind of can't not acknowledge their own journey, where kids are often oblivious to that. You only see the parents in a certain way from your own perspective. But I'm always touched by how, you know, the parents in this they're consciously trying to be parents, you know, but the best they can. You see them struggling, but they care enough to at least try. And I think that's the parenting, the best you can do. I have friends having their first kids, and they said, they're asking advice, and it's like, yeah, there is no playbook. I said, well, you're going to get it wrong anyway. Just try, you know, just put forth your best effort. The best thing your kid can say is, well, you know, they love me and they gave it their all, you know.
And taught me something about values. I mean, there is that in the film too, that parents can be, again, educators and a real source, even if their lives are screwed up and they make the wrong choices and do things in their own life that are really
tough. Yeah, make bad decisions. Yeah. We all do it. Mm-hmm.
Here's a listener, Bob in Berkeley, who writes, Richard, I haven't heard a reference to one of my favorite movies of yours. Waking Life is a film I have a copy of and show to friends here in Berkeley from time to time. In fact, just last week I told some friends about it, and we're going to watch it soon. It ties into my spiritual practice and philosophy quite beautifully. What do you think about that film in retrospect now?
Oh, I love it. It's very special in my own life, for sure. And in fact, this movie started right after that. You know, that movie came out in 01. We started this in 02. So in a strange way, I always felt this was kind of a follow-up. I mean, not specifically, obviously, it's so different, but just in my own journey, this is where I wanted to kind of – the next thing I wanted to do at that time. So, you know, it's just been a long time coming. But in Waking Life had a similar aha moment. I'd say of my films, Slacker, Waking Life, and Boyhood are related in some strange way, that they had these kind of – narratives that made absolutely no sense on paper. They were hard, you know, but I felt they had something to do with how we kind of go through the world or how we think or how we process. So Waking Life was very much that.
Just a couple questions about the film that occurred to me, minor questions, but there's a stepfather who actually is a professor, and they become a melded family. Was he supposed to have custody of those kids because he was a widower, or did he go through a divorce? That's not clear.
Well, yeah, it's not clear. It's off screen. So much of this movie, again, there's probably some legal explanation, but the kids wouldn't understand it. You know,
you want to stay with their point of view.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like even their own parents, Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette's divorce, they're not together at the beginning of the film because the kids, you never fully understand. You don't get the full explanation of why. You just get the kind of result. Daddy's moving out and here's where, you know, just sort of like we're moving. You don't get the full thought process or the history even. A lot of these things are mysterious to you. You just have to react to them. So I wanted that to be the point of view. It's just that's what it is for – there's some obvious reasons, but yet you don't know them. So it's not bad for an audience member to not know everything and have everything explained because I am trying to mirror the point of view of the kids.
Bring another caller on. Peter, that's you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I was fascinated about this project, and I'm really looking forward to watching it with my family. The main question I had was really regarding the parental permission that the child, I mean, the consent for the child to be a part of the movie. And as he grew up and became aware of what was going on around him in the movie, you know, the potential worry of what would happen if you wanted to pull out or take it in a totally different direction. How did you go through that whole process evolving over the 12 years of the project?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating life commitment for a six. I met Eller when he was six. He was seven when we started shooting. Like how it's almost a legal question. You know, you can't contract anyone in our society for more than 7 years to do anything, which is I didn't know that before, but I think that's a good law, especially anything to do with a kid. So but a six-year-old, obviously the parents are a big element of this. I was casting not just him but his parents who were participating in this life decision they were making with their kid potentially. I mean, they could drop out of the project any time and there's nothing we could do.
And as someone has said, what a cool name, Eller Coltrane.
I know. Well, he's a cool kid. He's got cool parents too. They're artists. And believe me, that meant a lot that his dad was a musician. He'd been in some bands I really liked. His mom's a dancer. Very cool. Very thoughtful.
Was
sensitive.
That the band in that played in
no,
the movie?
Oh. No. It was he was in some bands in Austin. You know, very, very much a music town. But I think they were inclined to think of this as a good thing maybe in their kid's life. Something to be a part of. They liked Ethan. They liked some of my movies or, you know, whatever. They just approached life as artists. So I thought that was very important, you know, and for the long-term health of not just the film, but him, you know, that he would see this as a positive thing. And then it was just up to me to make this a thing that he looked forward to doing every year. And that is, in fact, what happened. He speaks of it very eloquently about his life didn't have a lot of structure. He was largely homeschooled. And this was some structure he looked forward to every year and artistically and all that. So
I read some comments he made about seeing the film when it all came together. And I think the word he used was surreal to him.
Yeah, mind-blowing. For him and Lorelai, you know, my own daughter, they're in a unique position that no actors have ever been in. That they're playing these fictional characters. I mean, it's not them. But they are represented through those crucial developmental years where you change more than any time in your life practically. So there it is on the screen. So it requires them to kind of make their peace with that. And I think they're both still kind of grappling with that in their own way. But I thought on the upside of that, well, at least they'll be young adults by the time they'll have the mentality of a young adult to grasp or to process it all by the time anyone else is asking them about it. I mean, this was done privately, so they got the good part of making a movie, having that artistic collaboration, having this be a part of their lives as kids, but there was never a product. It never came out. No, there was no one picking on them in school because they thought they were cool or, you know, there was no backlash about being in a movie as a kid because no one saw it. So now they're young adults and hopefully they can deal with whatever comes their way like the rest of us when you float something out in the world that you've put yourself into. You never know what you're going to get back, positive or negative. But I think they're a little more prepared now.
You got sibling rivalry from your younger kids wanting to be in your films now and all that?
Yeah, I have two younger daughters who actually are in the very end, but they weren't even born when we started this. So, yeah.
We get a couple more emails and online comments, time permitting. And I just want to remind listeners that The film opens July 18th, and give some more information here about the film before we say goodbye to Richard Linklater. I just want to read an online comment, though, from Ed, who says, what do you like to get out of your rehearsal time with the actors, and how do you structure your shots? Shot list, short list, long takes? Also interested in how you manage to navigate the Hollywood studio findings versus indie funding approaches now that studios are more restrictive. That's a whole hour in itself.
Yeah, it? Yeah, and a depressing subject matter for sure. But so which question should I answer first? Maybe the Hollywood
long
one.
Shots,
it's like, sure. You know, you take what you can get in this world. Anyone who wants to give me money to make a movie, I'm thankful for and will run with if it's, you know, if it can get my movie made. But in the shots, I mean, rehearsal to me is where it really comes to life. To me, that's where, you know, the ideas and the words meet the person, and it, you know, that's the crucial moment that I enjoy so much. That's the taking that to another level is the fun part. But for me, it's not like improv or acting class or anything. It's really just a very rational process. We sit around and just talk a lot about it and read it through over and over and just keep a lot of it's rewriting and me thinking about, I do it for me as much as the actor, because I'm thinking how I'm going to shoot the movie. At some point, we're on locations rehearsing if we have that chance. And, you know, that's when I kind of figure out how I'm going to shoot the movie. I used to plan everything out in advance, the shots, and I was very specific about that. Now I've been doing it too long. I can just kind of feel my way through that rather easily.
No, it is a wonderful movie. Congratulations on it and ongoing success. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. Really nice talking to you.
Great talking to you. And let me give the information again about screening. Sneak previews tonight at 7:30 and 8 at the Embarcadero, 7:30 at the Kabuki. Tomorrow you can attend the opening night. Questions and answers for Richard Linklater in attendance at the Kabuki at 7 and at 8 and at 8:30 at the Embarcadero. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. And our interns, are Leslie Chang, Kathy Shield, Hannah Kingsley Ma, Charlie Zaharoff, Eric Nygaard, and Kaylin Dakin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.